The first thing Biden did was shut down the Keystone Pipeline and strangle off energy in America. Now with destabilization in Ukraine, oil prices will continue to spike. Of course, to the Biden administration, this is okay, because due to inflation and the limping economy, it'll be less likely that people can afford the gasoline for the Molotov cocktails they'd otherwise be throwing at them. Mike Pence tweeted out, "Under the Biden administration, we now have the worst border crisis in history. Inflation is at a 40-year high. Grocery store shelves are empty. Gas prices are up 50%, and Democrats are still pushing massive tax increases." Whereupon George A. responded with something appropriate. Raheem Kassam also had some pointed words for Mr. Pence.
Natalie, correct me if I'm wrong. I'm not sure that anybody was asking him to overturn an election, right? That he was going to bang the gavel and say, you know what, I think Trump should have another 4 years. That isn't what the point was. The point was to look seriously at the unlawful nature of what you described, Natalie, a lot of the changes that were made in election law, a lot of these drop boxes. You call it privatization. I call it corporatization of the US election system. And of course, to look into all of the other plethora of things, the ballot harvesting stuff, the machines even at the time were a big deal. The point of a presiding officer in an election is to factor in all of those things, all of those considerations. If not, why have a presiding officer at all? Why? What is the point of a presiding officer or a returning officer or an elections officer? What is the point of a Secretary of State appointing somebody who oversees elections if they don't want to oversee the election? Well, the same can be said of the vice president's role in the chamber in Congress. What is the point of presiding if you think your job, Mr. Pence, is just to grab an envelope from whomever gives it to you, open it up and say, and the winner is, then fuck off and host the Oscars. Because that is not the job of the vice president of the United States, and it's not the job of the vice president of the United States when you are the presiding officer in an election, not least a contentious election.
This got me thinking. Why did Mike Pence assume that the Electoral College was just an empty ceremonial body? The answer to that might interest you. It starts with the Founding Fathers' fear of America being degraded from a republic into a democracy. In a republic, it's representative government, where your goal is to send the wisest and most ethical people to operate the government on behalf of the people. In a democracy, by contrast, it's mob rule. The US Constitution was written in 1790, just as the French Revolution was getting underway. Americans were mortified by the new democracy in France that was imposed by the guillotine as the Reign of Terror kicked off. In politics, Aristotle describes democracy in much the same way as we use the term socialism. Aristotle said that in democracies, demagogues rise up, bribing their way into power by promising free food, free housing, free healthcare. It's not a pitch to a nation's highest ideals, but to its lowest common denominator. Instead of spiritual values like free speech, due process, or rule of law, the democracy promises things related to the senses, products, consumer goods. Of course, this is why democracies always collapse, due to loose fiscal policy. At any rate, to avoid the cheap and easy manipulation of demagogues, the founders wanted a system where the common people had a voice through the House of Representatives, but where the presidency and Senate, as two aristocratic bodies, could temper their excesses. This is what was meant by checks and balances. Other groups had to check the power of what in the wrong hands could turn into an idiocracy. One of the methods they used was property requirements to even vote. This was a holdover from the old British colonial system. If you didn't own land, you didn't get a vote. Why? Because you weren't taxed. And only people who were taxed could have a say in how the money in the treasury was spent. Likewise, it was thought that if you had land, you had a rooted interest in the community and you'd behave more responsibly. As a result, most citizens couldn't vote. Despite modern propaganda that leads you to believe that blacks couldn't vote under Jim Crow, but whites could, the reality was that 90% of whites couldn't vote either. This exploded with the Thomas Dorr Rebellion in the 1840s in Rhode Island, when Thomas Dorr, a school teacher, thought that average people should have a vote too. But the real reason that universal suffrage came in was not because of grassroots complaints by people like Thomas Dorr. Rather, bankers and merchants, as a new rising political power, couldn't vote either. Despite having tons of stocks, bonds, gold, cash, they rarely had land, especially in places like New York, Boston, or Chicago, where land was at a premium and it had been all bought up ages ago. These rich men wanted to abolish land requirements so that they could vote and get into office, whereas before, they couldn't. They know that they'd be unpopular, so they created a campaign to put people like Thomas Dorr out front, like frontmen, and make it look like it was a democratic challenge from the common man to change the system. Well, you get the drift. The law was eventually changed so that more people could vote. The results, however, were mixed. Yes, the merchants and bankers could now vote, but so could tons of other people. People they would have considered the rabble. So the republic was on its way to decaying into a democracy. Charles Beard, in his History of the United States, wrote,
In a short time, the spirit of democracy, while playing havoc with the old order in state government, made its way upward into the federal system. The framers of the Constitution, bewildered by many proposals and unable to agree on any single plan, had committed the choice of presidential electors to the discretion of the state legislatures. The legislatures, in turn, greedy of power, early adopted the practice of choosing the electors themselves. But they did not enjoy it long undisturbed. Democracy, thundering at their doors, demanded that they surrender the privilege to the people. Reluctantly, they yielded, sometimes granting popular election and then withdrawing it. The drift was inevitable, and the climax came with the advent of Jacksonian democracy. In 1824, Vermont, New York, Delaware, South Carolina, Georgia, and Louisiana, though some had experimented with popular election, still left the choice of electors with the legislature. 8 years later, South Carolina alone held to the old practice. Popular election had become the final word. The fanciful idea of an electoral college of, quote, good and wise men, end quote, selected without passion or partnership by state legislatures, acting as deliberative bodies, was exploded for all time. The election of the nation's chief magistrate was committed to the tempestuous methods of democracy.
In our original system, the president was not popularly elected. In our Constitution, only the congressmen in the House of Representatives were. Both the president and Senate were elected by a two-step process. Like the nomination of a Supreme Court justice, this was thought to preserve them from petty politics. In the case of the Senate, the people would elect the state legislators, and the state legislators would appoint the senators. As for the president, he too was elected in a two-step process. The state legislators were chosen by the people, and they, these wiser men, appointed electors at the Electoral College. This insulated the choice of president, as I said, from partisanship, or it was supposed to, as well as giving the states great control over the presidency. By 1824, this was eroded when political parties emerged and started having caucuses. Instead of the candidates going to the Electoral College to vie for the electors' backing, they were now voted on months earlier by political parties. By this method, control was yanked away from the Electoral College, and by extension the states, and now party bosses chose the president. This meant that the states lost control, and now the men who financed the political parties, the oligarchs, assumed power over who would be president. It was at that point that the Electoral College, thus our Constitution, was undermined. Power slipped away from the states to act as a check on the federal government, and control passed on to the business class. Much ink is spilled over the subject of election integrity, but hardly anyone asks why political parties are choosing our presidents. No one seems to notice that those political parties are not in our Constitution. In fact, George Washington denounced the idea of political parties at all, and said that the custom should never have been brought over from England. Nevertheless, we're now trained to think that the Republicans and Democrats, or rather, the billionaire oligarchs financing their shell companies, get to pick our presidents, and that the Electoral College is some ceremonial relic where men like Mike Pence open an envelope like they're at the Oscars with no more power than the janitor in the building.
By the time you go to the polls and you put your pencil mark on the paper, punch the lever, whatever you do, the decisions are already made. The candidates have already been selected. And the work goes on there, is who selects the candidates that the people vote for? Who frames the issues that the people vote for? Voting is nothing. It's all done before that stage.
Consider this. If we went back to the constitutional system where the Electoral College chose the president, then it would render all other controversies like sketchy electronic voting machines and shady mail-in ballots irrelevant. In fact, the people wouldn't be voting in the president at all because, well, they're not supposed to be in the first place. And the party bosses would lose all power, and the billionaire class would be denied much of the influence they currently have over our government. If you haven't already, go check out the New American magazine at thenewamerican.com. Think of the magazine as the terms and conditions on these videos, like the fine print that will reveal to you that by watching, you consent to me having power of attorney over you. Just teasing. But it does remind me of the German writer Heinrich Böll describing the yellow journalism of his day and saying that the headlines were there, with the articles underneath like the fine print in an insurance policy. Most people never read the fine print, and they pay the price. Be informed. Read the New American Magazine. Understand what's really going on.